Are your school days out of sight? When you took English, art, and math, what's your favorite Fahrenheit? How sour are the grapes of wrath? Do you need a challenger or disgusting Salinger? Do you love the written word? What happened to the mockingbird? Our show is just beginning, so find a place to sit. These questions will be on the test. It's time for Sophomore Lit.
Okay, testing. Are we on? Hello? Hi. Hi, it's me, John McCoy, back with another episode of Sophomore Lit for Thanksgiving. And as in earlier years, I've dragged my sleepy brother Dan downstairs from the nap he was taking after our Thanksgiving dinner.
Yeah, this is, normally I'm not that comfortable guesting, but then this is John decided to heighten it this time by saying that I was napping and then suggesting we do this right after I woke up. So,
well, anyway, as is the tradition for Thanksgiving, hello, hi, happy Thanksgiving, all everyone out there. We are doing yet another bit of school time Americana. And this time we are doing Casey at the Bat, which is the full title of this, I did not know until I looked it up on Wikipedia, is Casey at the Bat, a ballad of the Republic, sung in the year 1888 by Ernest Thayer.
That certainly makes it sound more important than it is.
Yeah, it's only, what, like, let's see, if the Civil War ends in 65, so, it's a little bit after the Civil War. I guess that then he can be forgiven for not mentioning the Civil War in his poem. This was first published in the San Francisco Examiner, this famous poem of batmanship, and that makes it like in a very small group of classics that first appeared in newspapers. There's this, there's Yes Virginia, there's a Santa Claus, and is there anything else?
Of what kind? At all?
I mean, is that what other newspaper features do we remember today from?
No, I don't. I mean, there are certainly things that were published in installments in magazines, but I don't recall it.
Well, Archie Mehitabel was a newspaper thing, I guess, so that counts. So anyway, this is Ernest Thayer's famous poem, Casey at the Bat. I know Dan read this because I saw him reading it this morning. fortunately, this is a poem you can just go right to the Wikipedia page and read it all through. Any observations, overall observations on this poem that we all, I think, were taught in like seventh or eighth grade?
Yeah, I mean, I was explaining what we were doing for the podcast to my girlfriend, and I was like, oh, this is arguably the most well-known American poem, and although the irony of that, of course, was that I was explaining it to her, who had never heard of it, it makes sense that it would become very popular as an American poem, because it's about baseball, the national pastime. It's very easy to read. It's a poem that tells a story in a regular sort of sing-song way with a easily understandable rhyme scheme, and it has a twist ending. So, it's lightly comic. it's not like you laugh out loud by any of it.
Lightly comic. I want to point out something here that I didn't know until I started doing research in this. So, is that Ernest Thayer, first of all, was another native Massachusetts guy. He was born in Lawrence, grew up in Worcester here in Massachusetts, and he went to Harvard, and he wrote for the freaking Harvard Lampoon. So I just want to say, The tradition of average white guys going on to become famous as comedy writers after writing for the Harvard Lampoon goes all the way back to the 19th century.
Yeah, and I picked up a copy of the Lampoon. I mean, like, this was a modern copy of the Lampoon, so maybe there were quote-unquote glory days that I missed, but you know, so the Harvard Lampoon, the National Lampoon, you can argue about for days because it is kind of an unpleasant magazine. Like, a lot of the humor is mean and geared toward women or minorities. It's the humor of punching down, but it is also like you can read them and be like, oh, those are jokes. Those are jokes. They work as jokes. I could see them being funny. Like, the copy of the Harvard Lampoon I picked up, I was just like, what is this? What is... This is what passes for humor? I don't understand.
Well, you know, for some reason, the Harvard Lampoon keeps churning out comedy writers for comedy TV shows. Mm-hmm. Lampoon begat the National Lampoon, which begat basically Saturday Night Live and stuff. So there is a tradition there. It's not necessarily a pretty one, but they do have in the Harvard Lampoon, I understand, they do have the original throne from the Dark Crystal. So that is, if you could ever get into that building, which I don't think people who don't write for that are allowed to go in because it's Harvard and they're full of their stupid little ways. And anyway, so that's Harvard. But we're going back now to Casey at the Bat.
Well, I mean, for its, you know, comedy value, I will say, I don't think it's a much of a spoiler alert to say that Casey ultimately strikes out. It's possibly the two most famous lines of a very famous poem, but there's no joy in Mudville. Mighty Casey has struck out, but there's a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13. I should have done this off air. 13 stanzas in this thing. And like, it's a short poem, compared to, you know, classic long epic poetry, but it's a longer poem maybe than we might be used to in our modern world. And the comedy value of having it be that long is I do think it builds sort of the proper amount of suspense there. Like, not to make a baseball pun, there's a big wind up to the ultimate like twist ending, and that helps it as a joke, I guess. I like, it's not really a joke. It's a fun poem. I don't want to make it sound like I don't like it in any way. I'm sure we're gonna end up talking about this anyway, but I think I was most familiar with it from the Disney cartoon they made that basically just reads the entire poem with a few changes.
We'll get into this in popular culture. Definitely. It is a long poem with this kind of lead up, and it's got this gentle humor to it. I would say it was in the Swiftian. The Swiftian genre, or the Pope, the Popian genre of Augustinian literature, where you know Alexander Pope's Rape of the Lock, where you're making a big deal out of a little thing.
Casey is not like a character that predates Casey at the Bat, but he feels like he is. He feels like a Pecos Bill type character that he's just invented out of whole cloth.
Right. Now, yeah, so I want to point out one thing here that was kind of interesting. I know this primarily first from the Disney thing and then from the various weird interpretations. I think they illustrated it in the old Mad comic once, and they also did it in like Marvel's Not Brand Eck. If anyone knows what that is, but there's a line in here where we were told about the, you know, Casey, the Mudville, whatever their team's name is.
Nine. Team name, I think.
The Mudville, we'll call them the Mudheads. The Mudville Mudheads are down 4-2, and they've got two out, and there are two people up before Casey, the star hitter, is going to come up, and so the audience in the poem, is in despair, and we're told that Flynn and Jimmy Blake precede Casey, and we're told the former was a Lulu and the latter was a cake. So I had to look up these things, and apparently Lulu simply means an unskilled player, but cake is either a phrase for a dandy or a 19th century, get folks, a homosexual gentleman. So thanks, Casey at the Bat, for confirming the stereotypes of the 19th century. But I was also amused that when I was reading this, there was a note by Martin Gardner, and yeah. I find that hilarious because for you know, Martin Gardner was such a feature of my childhood, and I think of yours too, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, I read the Annotated Alice over and over and over again.
Yeah, I think that, like, if I keep imagining that, like, in 1974 or so thereabouts, like, Isaac Asimov and Martin Gardner had this intense hatred of each other, and they were plotting each other's downfall so that they could be the ones to rule the world of light annotated publishing. So that's a reference that a certain age group out there will get, and no one else will care about. But it was nice to run into Martin Gardner while doing research on this. So anyway, Blake and Jimmy. Wait.
Jimmy Blake. Who's the other one?
Oh.
Flynn preceded Casey, right. And likewise Jimmy Blake.
Right. So these guys get on base. Casey approaches, and everyone thinks this is it. And Casey basically lets two strikes go by him. I mean, there's not. The jokes are okay, I guess. I mean, I read the Wikipedia article is kind of funny about this, because it says it talks about how it has some of the flavor, the references. It says the text is filled with references to baseball as it was in 1888, which in many ways is not far removed from today's version. I was like, yeah, there's nothing in here that, aside from the aforementioned Lulu and Flake.
Other than, I don't know, like small town rivalries, but it's not even like, that's not like different today necessarily. I thought, like, we keep referring back to the Wikipedia article, which shows how much research was done for this particular episode. But I do think it's interesting. There's a reference to a pre-publication version, and it does not. It's hard to tell how reliable it is. Like, there's just this one reference to it, but the poem as written is this poem of hubris where Casey is so confident in his mighty baseball powers that he lets two perfectly good pitches go by, you know, knowing that he's gonna hit a homer with the third one and then doesn't. But this pre-publication version supposedly has a part where he winks at his uncle in the audience, and it turns out that this was all a setup. He threw the game to make a little money. Which, I mean, if true, that's a great thing to cut, because it's much less interesting. Like, then it's just like I don't know. It's just a story of someone cheating at baseball rather than a story of, like, an arrogant man who sets his own downfall up.
Right. Well, you know, it does you know, change the entire tone of you know, and it makes you think of other great poems, you know, like we did the Courtship of Miles Standish. What if it were, you know, Miles Standish was, you know, involved in some sort of an insurance fraud too. but in any case, so this is a poem about baseball, and it's a silly short poem about baseball. It probably would have been lost to the ages if it hadn't been a favorite to be performed in vaudeville, which goes to show how dull vaudeville must have been.
Yeah, I have all of this fondness in my mind for vaudeville, just because, you know, talk about things that we read and reread as a kid. I read and reread Harpo Marx's autobiography, although it was clearly mostly ghostwritten. Or I mean, his not ghostwritten. The guy's name's on the cover, but like, but I have this romanticized view of it. It sounds fascinating to me, but like, so much of it, yeah, must have just been like a placard up. Like, now this man's going to read a poem, and like, now a song will be sung. Just like something popular to the time. It reminds me of when I went to England in college. One of the classes had us go to an old like music hall, like a recreation of a music hall performance, and it was again this kind of lightly comic, very of their time songs that like have stuck in my head years afterwards. Like this one, like that went something like, "Girls, girls, study your cookery books." And there's like one with us sailors being like, "All hands on deck, there's a pretty little maid in sight." And it's, you know, literally just like this series of character songs, like tableaus with people in costumes singing these songs. And it was fun as a time capsule, but it seemed utterly baffling to me as a thing that would have actually entertained people who came to watch it.
Right. Yeah. No, yeah. And to that point, this, I guess one of the things to note in this is that all the characters who get named in this have distinctively Irish sounding names, so there is this way in which it plays to that that kind of character of ethnicity, mm-hmm. that seemed to drive a lot of American humor at the time. The other thing I want to say briefly about vaudeville was I remember I was once trying to explain to my wife Marina about the old Abbott and Costello routine about Niagara Falls. And she'd never heard it. And I was like, I was trying to even remember why it was sticking in my head, or why I thought it was even funny at all. And I looked it up online, and I found out that didn't actually originate with Abbott and Costello. That was just like a routine that people did, mm-hmm. in vaudeville. So like, people going east to west would do it, and the people going north to south would do it. And,
yeah.
And it's such a strange thing to think, you know, today, the stand-up community is famous for sort of self-policing about joke stealing, that's a real bad thing to do, a real no-no if you're going to be a comedian, is to steal someone else's joke. But vaudeville seemed to just be like, okay, here's a joke, you take it for a while and I'll do it for a while. And
yeah, I mean, likewise with Who's On First did not originate with them. I think it just seemed to be that whoever did it best ended up being it, you know, sort of taking ownership of it in the popular imagination. But like, yeah, there are all these routines that were just kind of traded around, and it was like, okay, you have this one, and maybe best case scenario, you'd get a little money for it. But sometimes people will just steal it outright.
Yeah, yeah. So this was the what was it? This guy named Kelly. I guess he went by the name Kelly, was the guy who became the most famous live performer of this. But as you say, you and I both have strong memories of the Disney cartoon. It was originally a short in Make Mine Music that was recorded by Jerry Colonna. Mm-hmm. Jerry Colonna, who is one of these, if you grew up watching like old Disney movie cartoons, you probably knew these voices without knowing who they were, like Jerry Colonna and what's his name, the guy who played Captain Hook, Hans Conried.
No, sorry, finish your thought before I.
Yeah, Hans Conried or even like Paul Frees. You have these voices in your head that you know from that time, but Colonna was like this guy who was a radio performer who was known for just this yelly, declamatory style where he just yelled everything.
Now, in my mind, is he the same guy who would do the, like, sort of later Goofy cartoons where it would just be like a Goofy does a thing and it's sort of, like, presented as if it's educational and be like, "Ah, skiing!" You know what I'm talking about? Like
yeah,
the sport of kings.
I know who you're thinking about, but I don't think that was Kelowna.
Not the same guy.
Kelowna was the March Hare in Alice in Wonderland.
Mm.
And he has this very strident, like operatic voice. He would say, "Gadzooks, egad." And
oh no, I know. Yeah, I can sort of remember it now.
Yeah, and he was so this was a kind of so his whole thing, his whole shtick was just kind of heightening the operaticness of this. The Disney cartoon is okay. It's pretty straight. You know, they put in a few visual gags that aren't in the poem. But you know, if you grew up like I did in the 70s, you didn't see Disney cartoons very often. They would sometimes appear on The Wonderful World of Disney, and Casey the Bat was one of the ones that came into rotation. But in the very early days of the Disney Channel,
mm-hmm.
before the Disney Channel sold its soul to High School Musical and became like a tweener station, it didn't really know what it was doing. It had no real reason to exist. This was like when Disney was on the ropes and failing financially in the late 80s before The Little Mermaid saved everything. And and they had this show called Mousetrapiece Theater. Mm-hmm. That was Bill Plimpton. Now you
George
watched
Plimpton.
George Plimpton. Bill Plimpton.
That would have been interesting.
Yeah. So you watched that a lot as a kid. I remember you watching this.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Our family sort of. Looking back on it, I can track our family's progression from being like sort of on the edge of maybe lower middle class to upper middle class as we went. And, like at a certain point. Yeah, like the parents were like, "Oh, you're a child. We'll get the Disney Channel," and I saw so many old cartoons that are etched into my mind because of that in a way that I, never would have otherwise. And that was the big advantage to that they would show all these shorts. Like Disney, even when it's at its low ebb, like you say, the thing is, it has so much intellectual property that it can draw on from being around for so many years. Like, I just got Disney Plus, and there's certain new things, obviously, that I'm interested in, but the stuff I find the most fun is to just go back and they're like, okay, well, we have this lying around the warehouse. We'll throw that on the site, too, and I'll see this old weird thing.
Yeah. Yeah, Disney actually did a sequel to Casey at the Bat where Casey had a bunch of daughters that, mm-hmm. that vindicated his name or something, which I guess is cute enough. You can look it up if you care. So I don't think we have much more to say about Casey the Bat. Is there anything you wanted to
it's fine. No, I mean, I like it. My fondest word mostly comes from the cartoon. I think that maybe it's time for a new Casey at the Bat. No one seems to care much about baseball much anymore. It is our national pastime in name only.
So you were talking about a gritty reboot of Casey at the Bat?
Yeah, sure.
Well, you know, nothing strikes fear into the heart of criminals so much as a bat.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, that's it. Happy Thanksgiving, everybody. Have a great time. And next time, forgive us our nonsense this time. Next time, I will be back with an actual piece of literature that I will actually do some research on. And I will let Dan go back to upstairs, where I think we have pie now. And
I'm released from my curse.
And if you like us, listen to other shows on the network, the Incapable Network, and Facebook, and email me and stuff. Okay, bye.